You touched on it, and I'm curious to hear more about it, becoming a professional investor. A lot of people manage their own money. In your case, you started managing your family money, and eventually you opened up and you started managing other people's money. And there are three very different experiences.
I started with my father basically closing an account at a bank and sending that money over to me. I knew that there was a very, very significant proportion of my father's net worth. I was very, very scared. I knew it was the whole lot, 100% of his liquid net worth, and I was shaking.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. My guest today is Guy Speer. Guy Speer is a Zurich-based author and investor. He completed his MBA at the Harvard Business School and holds a first-class degree in PPE, Politics, Philosophy, and Economics from Oxford University, where he studied with the British Prime Minister David Cameron. After completing his MBA, Speer started the Aquamarine Fund, which is an investment vehicle inspired by the original 1950s Buffett partnership. In 2008, Speer made news by bidding $650,000 with his friend Monish Babrai to have a charity lunch with Warren Buffett. His book, The Education of a Value Investor, has sold more than 50,000 copies. Mr. Speer served as the chair and founder of the Weizmann Science and Business Club and as a member of the Harvard Business School Alumni Board. He currently serves on the advisory boards of Value Conferences and of Zurich Minds. He's the founder of ValueX Zurich and has co-founded TEDx Zurich and TEDx Zuriberg. From 2007 to 2009, Mr. Speer served on the advisory board of the Daxana Foundation. In 2017, Speer joined the newly formed board of the Swiss Friends of Oxford University and is on the board of the UN Watch. He's a member of the Entrepreneurs Organization and of the Young Presidents Organization. Guy lives in Zurich with his wife and their three children. Today, you'll hear about Guy's family history and how it shaped him and his investment philosophy, the risk of losing it all, skiing and investing. It's not the fastest skier that wins, but the one who doesn't get injured, the challenges and opportunities of managing your own family money and other people's money, creating the right physical, geographic, and social environment to flourish as an investor, the right and the wrong and ethics in the investment business. Success is not a number. And as a bonus, we'll talk about flying small planes and what it taught both of us about investing. My favorite quote shared by Guy, "It doesn't matter how slowly you go, as long as you do not stop." By Confucius. Please help me welcome Guy Speer. Hello, dear listener. I have a small favor to ask. If you're enjoying the show, please follow, subscribe, and most of all, share with everyone that would like it too. It's all word of mouth marketing. It's all up to your fingertips to make a small contribution and become an important part of the success of the show. Thank you. It's a real pleasure to see you again. We met a few times before at your investor event back in New York, I think 8 or 7 years ago. And then in Zurich, we had a nice lunch at John Michalczewicz's event on a mountaintop, which I remember very well. We spoke about many things. I mentioned to you my book, Money, Life, Family, that I was writing at the time, and you gave me some pointers.
Well, hi, Bogumil. Great to see you again.
So let's jump right in. I like to start from the beginning, if you don't mind. And I like to ask my guests about their childhood and upbringing and their relationship with money.
So you get the benefit of my evolving thinking on the topic. And obviously, I spend quite a bit of time thinking about why I am the way I am. And I think you're right to ask the question. And in my case, I think that if I trace my family history, and I think that what's fascinating about that is that there are, so you're asking about me, but I'm going to go back one or two generations, because there are patterns that echo through the generations. And if we really want to understand who we are, I think that we certainly want to understand our own childhoods, but then we want to go back because it's extraordinary how patterns propagate through multi-generation. So on my mother's side, my mother's ancestors were economic migrants, very clearly, who emigrated to South Africa during the Industrial Revolution, and they must have seen better opportunity in South Africa. My grandfather was a bank clerk, and my grandmother was a teacher. And then on my father's side, they were emancipated Jews. Germany, one side, my grandmother was from Berlin, so that would have been Prussia, and my grandfather was from Frankfurt. And this was a time of an extraordinary opportunity for Jews in that part of the world, because they'd been stuck in ghettos and suddenly they were enabled to be free citizens. My grandfather was a lawyer and my grandmother had been studying medicine, but was one of five children in a very successful industrial family in the south of Berlin. And then there's this huge event that Adolf Hitler comes to power, which is kind of like a key moment in so many people's family histories, and they have to get out quick. And they do get out quick, but they have to start again. And my grandfather becomes a farmer in Israel. And my grandmother could no longer study medicine. She ends up becoming a physical therapist. And my father grows up in an agrarian village in Israel. And he meets my mother, by the way, on a ferry between some Greek islands. My mother's doing some European travel before she goes and teaches in the UK. My father ends up, after a romance of 2 or 3 years, gets married to her in South Africa. And then they move back to Israel. And then we spent time, so I'm a young child then, and then we spent time in Iran, believe it or not. My father had a job at a German multinational selling agricultural chemicals to the Iranians. And then in 1977, we moved to the UK where my father started a business and I was a student and went to university. Why do I talk about it like that? In my own childhood, I saw my father working extraordinarily hard as the manager of a department inside a multinational in Iran, and then I saw him start a business in the UK. I think that now, from the perspective of now, I could think that those echoes of history, there's the seeking economic stability, seeking economic security, and also implicitly understanding the extraordinary fragility of economic security, even in the best of times. My father, not so long ago, says to me, "Life looks so good. It probably looks about as good as it did to members of our family, our ancestors in Germany in the late 1920s. And things can change so fast. By one decade later, my grandfather was a chicken farmer in Israel." That's the echo down the generations, if you like, the search for economic security. And I think that a second element is the desire to rebuild what was lost. So there was clearly a loss there. In 1989, around that time, we actually got restitution, as the descendants of that family got restitution of those properties that they had to abandon in Berlin. And that's kind of interesting. Then I think that it's in my nature. I've only realized this recently, actually through observing my children, that I'm a high anxiety person. And I think that different people have different set points for anxiety. And it's there's not much you can do to change it. And it's good to know where you sit on that spectrum. And so I think that drove me to study harder than I would have otherwise studied at universities and schools. And I think that drove me harder in the search for economic security. For some people, if they have their daily meal and they have a roof over their heads, that's enough. And there are other people for whom any amount of money is not enough, but they're actually in search of economic security. I actually think if we take George Soros, another Eastern European, but not from Poland, from Hungary, I suspect that a big part of what's driven him throughout his life is the search for economic security. And the strange thing is that, I don't know if you know the movie The Deer Hunter, but it is the tragic moment in the movie, I believe, is that this guy has this searing experience where he's forced to play Russian roulette with his friends as a prisoner. Mm-hmm. And then the Vietnam War ends and he has to relive that nightmare. So he stays in Vietnam, and he continues to play Russian roulette, even though there's no obligation. And obviously his friend comes to try and find him and bring him back, but he's caught in a nightmare that is no longer a nightmare. He just has to step out of it. I think that there are powerful patterns where George Soros, for example, is not a nightmare, but he started in a search for economic security, and that kind of is part of his makeup. He can't get rid of it. It's not a terrible thing at the end of the day. It's It's possible that Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, part of what drives them is that they were young children during the Great Depression. And so that mm-hmm. would have impacted them in one way or another, in ways that they may not be conscious of. Just to finish off my very long answer to your very good question, is my experience of growing up was that my father had started a business and there was increasing economic security and economic plenty around. I remember at age 16 or 17, my father had bought a holiday home in the south of France. And I just remember thinking, my God, this is something special. And so that feeling of quality of life and spending power, ability to spend on oneself and one's education, one's leisure, one's well-being, that is a wonderful feeling if your spending power is increasing as it did. It's not so nice if and when it decreases. My fund started with, so I was looking for a job as an analyst when my father came to me and said, would you like to try, I'd really like you to try managing some of this money that I've saved. And so that's where it started for me. Just to come back to the very beginning of your question, I'll hand the mic over to you, Bogmil, before I talk too long.
That's actually one of my following questions. But I wanted to ask you about risk aversion, because when I'm listening to you, you're talking about stability and reaching a certain level of economic comfort and making sure that it lasts. But I'm immediately thinking of risks and managing money for families as we do at Secret Associates. I'm thinking that there are certain risks that are not acceptable even for the wealthiest people. How do you think about risk in the sense of losing it all?
The first statement that comes to my mind is, I think it's a famous one from Warren Buffett, is it's a very dumb idea to risk what you have and you need for what you don't have and what you don't need. I think secondly of friends and colleagues in the investment business who will accuse somebody like me of being in the stay rich business rather than in the get rich business. I mean, Warren and Charlie have said that they wouldn't really like to have to start again. Yes. They're very glad that they are where they are. And I think that to be forced to start again or to lose it all is the ultimate definition of failure. I mean, you cannot get a better definition. I mean, you're there to preserve and grow wealth. It seemed to me to be one of the number one priorities of somebody who's in wealth management, and so if you lose it all, you're done. you've failed in the most profound way possible. How can you earn a living? You can earn a living out of your labor. That's what the vast majority of humans do. And there's a very small proportion of us who are extraordinarily privileged to be able to pay our life through leveraging. If you manage to run a law firm or an advertising firm, you're leveraging off other people's labor. And if you're extraordinarily fortunate, you can leverage yourself off capital. If you lose the capital, you can't do that anymore. You've got to go back to, selling your time. That is an outcome to be avoided at all costs. That's the name of the game. How one does that, and B, what psychology does one need to get, and what do we need to do in order to get there, and how much of it can you learn or create for yourself, and how much of it is just innate is a great question. Some of the world's smartest, most sophisticated people have gambled it all away. Sam Bankman-Fried is the one that comes to mind right now, but we just have to think of LTCM, long-term capital management. Mm-hmm. They did the same thing. I think that we all discover stories. I mean, in terms of losing it all, an interesting criterion, which is quite morbid actually, but how many suicides have you had? So in the 2008-09 financial crisis, there was a period when people threw themselves out of buildings. You can imagine that they were in a position where they had lost it all. And rather than start from scratch, they decided to end their lives. And I've understood there's been either people being pushed out of windows or people throwing themselves out of windows around coin Sam Bankman-Fried, FTX, today. Mm-hmm. So I think that this question has some parts. So I'll stop there and see where you go with the.
It's interesting because I remember my very first conversation with my future partner and boss, François Sicard. And when we sat down in Paris, when I was still a student there, I had all the questions for him, how I can avoid losing money. And he found it so refreshing that this young kid from grad school is not asking, how can I make more and how fast I can make more? But I was obsessed about all the places I shouldn't go so I don't lose money. And I always felt that the upside will take care of itself. And I don't know where it came from, but it was a very powerful conviction that I had. It never left me that any investment I look at, I want to know how it can go wrong first before I get excited about the upside. And
well, I want to dive in with a set of ideas, which I think are extraordinarily powerful, if I may. Before I do that, I have not been to Poland. I have been to Czech Republic and to Hungary. But I think that it's possible, given, you know, I've been learning a little bit the history of Poland because we're all looking at Ukraine. When your country's been completely swallowed by your eastern and western neighbors, I think more than once, and it's been hungrily eyed by surrounding empires. And so the country has won its independence. It's felt the hard knocks of history. And I just wonder, you know, my question is, how much does that factor into your psychology? And I think that if, I suspect it does a lot. And I think that if I was a client, I would be asking you, I would want to learn how your experience, your historical experience, because these histories, even if we're not aware of the history, they come into our nervous systems, how that impacts. You know, if you've lost your whole country and you know how easily that can happen, then you definitely want to pay attention to your investments, you know?
Exactly. So
set that aside and I'll tell you something that's on my mind. I'm writing my annual letter and this a lot of this will probably make it into the annual letter. So you're getting a preview here. Do you ski at all, Bogmil?
I do.
So there we go. That's so. But you're probably not a professional skier, but
no.
But I'm quoting from a book by a guy called Luca Delana, who's based in Turin, and he's a kind of a practical academic, if you like, could easily have been a professor at multiple universities, but has chosen to live a more independent life. It's not the fastest skier who succeeds.
Right.
It's the fastest of those who don't get injured. And the problem with much of life is that if you have a season of 10 races and you get injured in race three, you don't get to compete in races 4 to 10. Mm-hmm. And so you're out. Too many people compete in each race thinking that they have to be the fastest. And if they try to be the fastest, they might draw an extraordinarily lucky card in life and compete in all 10 races trying to be the fastest and end up winning the season. But if you want to be really smart about it, then in each race, you're not going to race the fastest. You're going to race in a way that will ensure that you get down without injury. And then subject to those constraints, you will do the best you can. Because if you can just survive, many of your fastest competitors will be eliminated because they're pushing the boundaries too far. So I'm now going to use a word that many of my friends hate me using. The word is ergodicity. And Luca Delana's book is titled Ergodicity. And the guy in London, the London Mathematical Laboratory, Ole Peters, has written a number of papers about this. And it all comes down to there's some huge flaws in the way economic theory is written. And it assumes things about people and about the environment that are not true. And I'll just give you one other example of that. If you're a general in an army and you lose a battalion, you might sacrifice a battalion in order to win the war. That's a perfectly legitimate decision to take as a general, a horrific decision, but it's a decision that generals and armies take all the time. If you're a member of that battalion, not a great thing. So what is your perspective? Where are you coming from? Much of economics assumes that everybody's perspective is the same, and it's not. And so the number of times you see really smart people betting the farm, I think is the American expression, as they did at LTCM, or as Sam Bankman-Fried did, and you don't have to do that.
I like that. Investing exactly works the way you describe it. And I think it's very confusing for people because people get into investing because they want to make money. There's a concept of an infinite game and a finite game. I'm sure you've heard of it.
You know, I was going to bring that up and it's so awesome. Do you like Simon Sinek's book or James Carse's book?
Both of them. I like the older one.
Yeah. Carse is awesome. But Simon Sinek did a great update. Absolutely.
And I thought that the way we look at life and games that we play, including investing, as winning and losing. We even use those words, winners and losers of the day, of the week, of the month, of the year. But if you think of it as a lifelong game, or maybe even in case of our clients, if you want to call it a game, but something that lasts over multiple generations, the one thing you don't want is to lose it all at any point because you're out of the game.
Right.
The goal is here to be able to continue to play. You don't have to be the fastest, as you said, but you have to be able to show up every time.
Absolutely. It's shocking. I feel very bad so I think that there are many people who've gone very quiet right now because they've flamed out, unfortunately. meaning that they didn't realize that they were betting the farm, but they were actually betting the farm. There's a quote that I saw on my Bloomberg monitor, and I cut and pasted it and put it onto my Twitter feed. And I hope you don't mind. I'm going to just look it up because I want to get it right. It's by a Chinese philosopher, and you'll love this because it's in the same direction, and it's coming up shortly. Forgive me for this, but hey, this is real time stuff, and it is.
Let's find it.
Where is it? Yes, there we go. So this is Confucius. Uh-huh. It does not matter how slowly you go, as long as you do not stop.
That sums it up.
Yeah, exactly. If you want to take it into, you haven't asked the question, but if you want to take it into specific investing, so what I realize is there are so many businesses where you want to have an end point, mm-hmm. which is an inevitable in the business. Right. And it doesn't matter how long it takes to get there, but the end point is something that is just certainly going to be there. So, you know, in the UK, there is this concept of leasehold ownership, and you can mm-hmm. buy a lease on a property for 999 years. They'll sell you a lease for 999 years, but the property owner is the crown, is the king of England, effectively. And if you do the discounting, the percentage of the value that is left in after 999 years is minuscule. But it violates this idea that you own the very end. At the very end, it's all yours type of deal. And what I find is that the kinds of businesses that Berkshire invests in are always kind of like, at the end, you're a winner, you know? And this idea that I don't know what's going to happen. I usually know what's going to happen. I don't know exactly when. And so you mm-hmm. want to see your way to an end that you is a kind of like a positive one.
So favorable.
Yeah.
You touched on it. And I'm curious to hear more about it, becoming a professional investor. So a lot of people manage their own money. In your case, you started managing your family money. And eventually you opened up and you started managing other people's money. And there are three very different experiences. Can you talk about it, what it's been like to go through this path of from your own money all the way to accepting other people's money? It's very different when the only client you have is the person you see in the mirror, and then having outside clients with their own emotions and feelings.
I can talk about my journey. It will not correspond to your journey or anybody else's journey because it's so specific, I think. Mm-hmm. And so the way to learn from this is to use me as one data point. And the way I can make the learning and the insights as great as possible is to give us, within the time constraints, to give plenty of color and detail, because the devil is in the details in these things. So yes, I started with my father basically closing an account at a bank and sending that money over to me. I knew that there's a very, very significant proportion of my father's net worth. And so I was very, very scared. And actually, I think that if we look at my father was a very, very good in business, an extraordinarily gifted creator of relationships and capacity mm-hmm. to bring people along into the kind of situation that would be beneficial for everyone. But when it came to investing, you have these kind of counterintuitive actions that you need to take, which for somebody who's not very powerfully analytically based, so usually with a very strong grounding, I would argue in mathematics and other kinds of sort of like hard subjects, it's very, very hard to be in. It's in fact, a lot of the actions are counterintuitive. So, you know, I think that if my father had understood concepts of portfolio allocation and risk, he might have taken 10% and said, start with this, let's see how you go. In any case, so he sent me the whole lot. I knew it was the whole lot, sort of like 100% of his liquid net worth, and I was shaking. And so one of the rules that I created for myself was that he'd sent me over So the previous firm had invested his money in laddered bonds. So bonds with expiration dates going out, some expiring in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. And I made a rule for myself that I would not sell those bonds early to buy an investment. My plan was to convert all of those into equities. I knew that long-term equities was the place to be. So I had a kind of like a 5-year program of bonds coming due, which would then provide fresh cash for new investments. But it was very clear to me as well that I wanted to do this in a way that I could take outside money. And so in parallel to taking over this portfolio, I worked on setting up a fund. And I was hugely influenced by Warren Buffett saying, put all your eggs in one basket, manage the basket. And the first couple of investors were partners of my father, or business and former business partners of my father's. I would say that I never sought out people's money, and I was in a very strong position not to have to do that because I could make ends meet with the money that I had. And, you know, I've said this many times, but I don't feel like I can say it often enough. I have enormous respect for people like Monish Pabrai, who had a very different path. His path was that he sold a business. He had to succeed at running an operating business and selling it before he could move on to investing, which is something I'd kind of started off doing. And I don't think that I have the skills. So I have a much narrower range of skills than, at least in the business world, than Monish does. I don't think that I would have been very good in starting and running a business. Who knows? Maybe it's a luck thing, but that's what I believe. So I had that advantage. And then I would also say that maybe it was wisdom. I wanted to make sure that these new clients didn't invest a huge proportion of their assets with me. So making sure that you know, if somebody invests 100% of their assets with you, they're going to feel about you one way. They invest 10 or 20%, they're going to feel about you another way. I would never want to be more than 10 or 20% of somebody's total net worth. The fund that I run should be 100% of my net worth. That's absolutely right. But it shouldn't, because it just could create a strain in the relationship. I think that having outside investors, we know, and we'll probably get into some of the disadvantages, but there are enormous advantages in that you have to professionalize what you're doing. So there are many, you know, I call them here, Bogmil, indecent proposals. The friend who comes by the office and wants to convince me to do something, and they're using the personal relationship to try and make it happen. And, you know, if it's around investing, it's far easier to say, hey, you know, I just couldn't do that. I mean, you know, this is not my own money that I'm investing. Yes, some of it's my own money, but it's in a vehicle that it's, because they'll say, oh, do it in your personal account, you know? And it's like, no, I don't have a personal account. I have one account, and this is, and how would I justify this to all of my outside investors? I could never. So it gives you the ability to act in a professional way where people are seeking convince you to act in a personal and non-professional way. Although I still have probably, there are many ways which people still get to me. And so there are enormous advantages. I mean, obviously, the minute you get outside clients, there are market ups and downs, and clients get nervous in one way or another. I think that to the extent that you can argue that my father was my first client, I went through a huge educational process with him. So I can tell you that within 2 or 3 years, one of the first stocks I was buying, so Berkshire Hathaway is one of those periods where Berkshire Hathaway is down 50%. And I was buying it all the way down, and my father was getting more and more nervous. He didn't know, he was like, and he didn't sort of say, what the hell are you doing, guy? But he kind of like just asked questions on a more frequent basis about what was going on. Right. He actually joined me at one of the Berkshire Hathaway meetings, and he sat there at the beginning of the meeting, and he listened carefully for about 20 minutes. And after about 20 minutes, he told me, so, okay, I get it. He said, the guy is just, he tells the truth the way it is. There's no there's no lies. There's no angling. There's no slant. And so we've now been together, my father and I, through, I don't know, 3 or 4 major market downturns. And so, you know, I had a down year last year. I'll find out in a day or two, we'll get the final NAV for the end of the month. And I know we're approximately down the same as the market, but my father and I really don't care because we kind of like have been through it. So that's he's somebody who did not come from the value investing church, is not analytically, that's not his strength, but it's taken a 25 years for him to be at that place in the relationship. And there are many investors that I have who are not in that place. I even had an investor in October or so, or maybe in the middle of last year, who wanted to call up and complain. And it's hilarious because it's like, well, you know, it's not, do you think I like it, A? Do you think I wanted this? And do you think that I have any influence over this? I can, you know, I didn't actually have the conversation with him, but what I would have wanted to say is, I'm in the business of planting vineyards. Every year I plant a vineyard. I plant the best vines I can in the best location. I water them the best I can. I give them the best sunlight. And then the seasons come and the grapes grow, and some vintages are going to be fantastic and some vintages are going to be less good. And overall, right. we will have wine to drink. But, you know, don't come and complain that this year the wine sucks because the weather's bad. What am I supposed to do? You know, jump up and down and yell at the sun, yell at the rain, yell at the frost. In any case, I would say that in terms of managing relationships with investors, a few things have helped. Obviously, long-term relationships helps.
Well, I immediately like what you started with, that you had your bonds maturing over time. That gave you time to ease into it. And I think that's very helpful. With our clients, in some cases, they might receive substantial wealth pretty much overnight, whether it's a sale of a business, stock-based compensation, or family inheritance. And they have to learn very quickly how to operate in this new environment. But with those bonds, you kind of had time to ease into individual investments and build a portfolio over time. Yeah. I like the sound of it. I think of a question I don't know if you're willing to answer, but have you ever fired a client?
it's a fantastic question. I think that let's just say that there are clients that we have been more enthusiastic about meeting their murmurings to redeem. Everybody wants to redeem, can redeem, obviously, but we kind of like, so we move faster to do that, and we're happy to be shot of them, if you like. But it's not something that I like to do, and it's not something I'm happy about. But yeah, I think that your point is, if I stop and think about it, it's maybe 2 or 3 out of 200 over the years. I think that the reason why I'm sort of having a hesitant reaction is that I know that somewhere it's been written you should fire X percent of your clients every year. I think that the word fire is not the right expression. And it's an Americanized thing. It's a wonderful thing to say because it gets eyeballs but you know, it's more a case of we don't want them as closely in our lives. And these people may well are very likely to be great people in all sorts of ways, but for one reason or another, it's not productive for us to have them so close to us. And so it's not about firing them, it's about positioning them correctly, if you like. And if you're a networker or a salesperson, an aspect of networking and sales is the act of sorting. And just because somebody is not your ideal person doesn't mean that you have to call them up and say, you're not my ideal person, therefore I'm only inviting you to one event every 5 years. You just have to quietly let them move into more of a distant relationship, if you like. And so I think that that's the kind of goal.
I think that's a beautiful way to put it.
We haven't talked much about your business, but for many businesses, and I certainly feel that way about mine, is that I want every one of our customers, clients, investors to be special and to feel special, and for me to value that relationship. And I would like to be in a place, maybe I'm already in that place, maybe I will get there, that I want my clients to be proud that they're my clients, and I want them to feel good. You know, I've actually said somewhere, it would be a mark of success for me if unprompted, I discover that somebody, person A, who's invested with me, says to person B at a dinner party, I am so pleased that I'm invested with Guy. So many good things have happened, where I perhaps in the future might be able to say, I would love to take your investment. We have no capacity. That would be a good thing. So that's the other side of firing clients, is constantly seeking to upgrade the quality of one's client base so that you have really a super high. And I think that if I think of my ValueX conference, I don't want to get rid of participants because they form a part of a community. But I want every participant to see the new people we let into the conference and say, my God, I'm so glad I joined early because I'd never be allowed in anymore. Something like that. So, because they're just like, look at the high quality people who come in. So it's kind of like a reverse Ponzi. A bunch of yo-yos get together and they keep trying to recruit and succeed. Hopefully they get better themselves, but they recruit into their network better and better people until they look around and say, my God, these people are so awesome. How did we ever get here? Something like that.
I like that. In our case, most of our clients, these are long-term relationships that lasted many generations already. The senior partner is approaching his 80s, and he worked with some of the clients for 3-4 generations, if not more. And then his late boss partner from the 70s worked with some of those families even before. So the core of the firm is very long-term relationships. The interesting opportunity is inviting new people to the family, so to speak, and making sure that we invite the people, as you mentioned, that fit, and where we are the right manager for them and they're the right client for us. And it's something that you discover over many conversations, and hopefully you don't make a mistake in that sense, that it's a waste of time for either of the sides, but it's a fun experience.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about something you mentioned in your book, The Education of a Value Investor, a wonderful book that I read more than once. You talk about the environment, creating the right environment, and you and I talked about it briefly before we started the recording, but tell me more about creating the right environment for your work. That's something that a lot of investors don't think about at the beginning. Everybody wants to be in a big city. For me, it was New York. I can only be an investor in New York, and I learned over time that it's not the only place, and you and I know that Warren Buffett chose a small town, city in the middle of the country, far away from everything. What are your thoughts about the correct environment for you to flourish as an investor?
Yeah, and so a bit like, and I hope that I gave enough color and detail on your previous question to make it useful. And I feel like I want to do the same thing here. And so first of all, see, here's kind of like updates from since I wrote the book. And just for anybody who has not read the book, I talk a lot in the book about moving to Zurich, which is a quieter place. I talk a lot about setting up my office in such a way that there's a room without a computer and not having the Bloomberg monitor nearby. I talk about Nick Sleep, and who puts the Bloomberg monitor on a low stool so that it's hard to look at. So you can't, it gets uncomfortable looking at it. So I talk about how I believe in the book about how walking outside the place where our office is outside, there's a beautiful garden, and how that is a very, very different thing to coming out in the streets in New York City. I think that all of that has an enormous amount of validity for many, many people. But I think that the way people's minds are put together is extraordinarily different. I realize now, so I now have kind of fully embraced a diagnosis I got 20 years ago of ADHD. And I can see that part of what works for me in Zurich is that Zurich is an extraordinarily structured environment. People think in a structured way. People accuse the Swiss, and especially the German Swiss, of being boring. And my response has often been, boring is good. But that structure is something that somebody of my mindset craves. Because when there's structure around me, I have the freedom to be creative. I have the freedom to think. I have the freedom to do all sorts of things. One of the jokes that is told about people with ADHD is it's hard to change the world if you can't find your keys. Equivalents of can't find your key moments are reduced massively in a place like Zurich, because if a train or a tram doesn't run on time once a month or once every 6 months, it's an item for the front page news, you know? And if there's, so it's kind of like everything works like clockwork. So what's my point? My point is that at the time that I wrote that, for my mind, a place like Zurich is extraordinarily helpful. I think that there can be other minds for whom a place that is like Mumbai or New York or a similar kind of crazy hectic place is actually the right place, even for value investors. So that's one thing. And so, you know, we need to kind of like really learn how our own mind works and kind of become an observer of our own mind. When am I bubbling with ideas? When am I trembling with greed? And why am I trembling with greed? When am I not? To see all of those things, what impact does the environment have on me? Because I think that there's a whole other side to one's environment. So what I do a lot in the book and what I've done up to now is talking about one, the physical environment, geographic space in which one is operating in. I actually think that, and that for some people, it may be irrelevant. For some people, I think it is important for me, but different people may benefit from different kinds of environments. I actually think that there's something about the mountains that helps me. I like proximity to mountains. I get sad when I'm in places that are flat. I also get sad in places where there's not access to bodies of water. So at least here in Zurich or in Switzerland, you have access to mountain lakes. But Places like San Francisco, Cape Town, south of France, where you've got mountains and sea nearby, truly wonderful.
Perfect.
But there's a whole other dimension to environment that I think today is far more determining than one's physical environment. And that is the environment that you create through the relationships that you have. And where it started for me was that the fact of the matter is, one of the most successful investment firms of the Buffett Munger mindset has been Ruane Cunniff. Ruane Cunniff is firmly based in New York City. And then you have First Manhattan, which is also firmly based in New York City. So I was asking myself, what's going on there? I can't speak to the culture of the firms and the physical environment that the people who work in those firms live and work in, other than the fact that they're based in New York City. But I realized that, so what happened to me is that there is a Yale professor who's also a doctor whose name's gone right out of my mind. Sorry about that. We'll have to put it in the show notes. But he wrote a book on obesity and how they were looking for predictors of obesity. And one of the studies that they did was that it turns out that the person who is in your social network, if you have a social network that is obese, you're statistically more likely to be obese than if your social network is not obese. And what's interesting is that they had a way of doing the analysis where it wasn't via, they could distinguish social networks from the zip codes you live in or the institutions that you attend. It's not the people you ride the tram with. It's the people that you're actually in social engagement with. I don't know if they've furthered that, but we can posit reasons why. So, you know, if you're a sports person and you say, oh, come with me, let's hang out next weekend. I'm going to be playing tennis with my friends. I'm more likely to be sporty and therefore I'm more likely to be healthy and less obese. Whereas if in my friend network, it's like, let's hang out and eat junk food and watch and play video games, then I'm more likely to be obese. So the kinds of activities we take on, the activities, of, you get the idea. And so I think that there's a similar phenomenon that is very, very likely to be happening with our investment friends and the people that we talk about investments to and the people, why have I attended the Berkshire Hathaway meeting for the last 25 years? Is because every time I attend, I make it more likely that the other people who attend become my friends and enter into my social network. And as a result of them entering into my social network and having interactions with them that were reinforced by going to the meetings, I make it more likely that I'm going to behave in ways that are consistent with long-term compounding, because that's what we're all looking to do. And so I actually think that physical environment is important, more important for me probably than for other people. The social environment is kind of trumps all of that, who we choose to have in our network, which, by the way, is another reason why we want to gently edge our way out of certain client relationships and find our way into other client relationships. A company's shareholder list also forms a kind of a social network, as does its board of directors. And so there's been no studies of this, but there are investments that the obvious one is Berkshire Hathaway, but it's not the only one where the investment is influencing the way I think and is teaching me. My first investment in Duff & Phelps taught me so much about the credit rating agencies and the credit rating business, but what was great about the credit rating business in general and about information services businesses. When I invested in Weetabix, which was a kind of like a British branded cereal company, it was through my investment in Weetabix that I ended up meeting Nick Sleep, because he discovered that I was also an investor in Weetabix, wanted to get to know me. It was through my investment, maybe in Duff & Phelps or in Weetabix, I don't remember, that I met this amazing investor in California called Alan Bonello, and through with whom we shared other ideas subsequently to that. Yeah, there was somebody else that I was going to bring up in that regard, but they taught me. Now imagine that there's somebody I know who's a big bull on Tesla, you know, and I don't want to say, so Tesla attracts a very, very different kind of shareholder base. And there's a huge proportion of Tesla shareholders who believe that the share price is only driven by Elon Musk's announcements. And they're not actually looking at the intrinsic value of the business. So if you're a shareholder of Tesla, you're more likely to start thinking in that way. And so a consideration of what kind of shareholder list am I joining and do I want to have these people around me? And so actually, one of the things that goes into my position sizing, I have shares in one company in India whose name I don't want to mention for the purposes of this discussion, where I want to be an influence on the company, not the other way around. If they were too large a proportion in my portfolio, it's more likely that they would influence me than that I would influence them. By contrast, Mm-hmm. Berkshire Hathaway, I want as much influence as I can possibly get. Long answer to a simple question on environment.
In your book, you say it's difficult, if not impossible, to become successful on your own. And I think it's such a powerful statement because a lot of people see investors as somebody that's on their own in a closed room. But there's so much interaction with your community of people that share ideas and views. And as you said, you become shareholders in the same companies. You continue to learn from each other. And it's a community of people around the world that follows principles and rules. And it's not a solo pursuit, as it seems.
And I would say that on a daily basis, we can work to improve the quality of our environment. If you take the social environment, we can work on a daily basis by reaching out. So a simple idea that every time, it doesn't happen every time, I wish it did. I'm not, I haven't yet structured that into the environment. That somebody sends me a great investor letter, whether it's theirs or somebody else's. If I possibly can, I want to write a personal note to the person who wrote that letter saying, wow, I read your letter. You're doing great work. I really appreciate it. It's selfish, long-term greedy. I mean, I'm giving a gift of appreciation to the person who did it. But what I'm trying to do is increase the probability that I'll come into contact with them and something good will happen. That is daily work. And is one of my inspirations, actually, for that. Is an unusual one. It's Nelson Mandela really was more extraordinary than I thought he was when he was alive. We talk about his I don't remember how many years he spent in prison, about a quarter of his life. I think it was more than 20 years. He was not doing nothing in prison. And he was in active communication with the rest of the planet or with people outside in very, very smart and sort of like, we deep value type ways. So, and the one example that I know of is that he reached out to songwriters, and he didn't ask them to, but he particularly reached out to songwriters who were writing songs that were quietly subversive to the minority white apartheid regime of the time. And, so he was kind of saying, if I can encourage that songwriter to write songs that the population of South Africa will sing, that will keep the dream of one man, one vote alive. That's, and another guy who, I don't know how successful he can be, but I hope he's drawing inspiration for Nelson Mandela is Alexei Navalny, who's sitting in prison in Russia right now. And there's another one that Vladimir Kara-Murza, and a very, very tough place to be. And I think to a large extent, those two guys are doing that. But in a certain way, what you and I doing in dark rooms alone is engaging with the world in that way. So.
Exactly. I wanted to ask you about right and wrong and ethics in the investment business. You and I talked about it over lunch in Zurich quite a bit. I'm coming up on 2 decades in the investment profession, and I have seen regulations and compliance swell and grow. But I also see the complexity and variety of unethical practices expand. You mentioned some of them in this conversation. I feel like there is a certain inherent right versus wrong compass that we all have. And you talk about playing center court, far away from the edges. Can you talk more about it, how you think about right and wrong and ethical business and investment practices in this world of ever-changing business practices?
I have a debt of gratitude to Buffett and Munger in 1,000 different ways. But when it comes to my own practices, I think I have an enormous debt of gratitude because I think that I've been traveling on a journey towards the center of the court. I think it's very common, especially amongst immigrants, perhaps people who've been deprived of everything in life other than their life or of all of their wealth, to view with a very jaundiced eye the rules and the regulation. I think that there was certainly, coming from my father's generation, many people in that generation who have had the culture of the rules are there to see where you can violate them so that you can get what you want. I think that we have to make a distinction. The distinction that I make is that we have the West, democratic liberal societies, where rules are made for the benefit of all. There's a careful consultation process, and there are parliaments, and there are that set of rules is that's where I choose to live. And so I did not, if I go to previous generations, that was not where those people grew up. They grew up in autocratic regimes where there were minorities that were to be persecuted, exterminated, kicked out. So I think that when you look at those kinds of societies, those kinds of societies exist today. I don't think that Iran is a very pleasant place right now. I think that somebody in Iran, you have to be unbelievably smart, way smarter than you would have to be in a place like the United States, Switzerland, Western Europe. In Iran, I will understand why somebody would not comply with the rules, because the rules were made in an unjust way. But I think that you take somebody who's lived in an autocratic place where the rules might be there to catch you out and to do an injustice to you. It takes a while to start adjusting to the fact that the rules are being made for everybody's benefit in a free and democratic way, all those good things. And so that's the journey that I've been on to move into the center court, if you like. But I think that where you get to a place, and this should be pretty obvious, I'm amazed that it's taken me so long to get there, where clearly the bare minimum standard of behavior is to comply with those rules. To understand, the only place, I don't know why I'm diving into politics, I've been spending quite a bit of time in the UK, and there is this anti-global warming movement that are engaging in some pretty counterproductive actions. They're blocking highways, and they're throwing oil onto paintings and trying to get the UK government to make different choices on global warming and carbon taxes and the like. But there's a very good culture of civil disobedience in which you deliberately violate some rules of behavior in society in order to draw a point. A good example is the suffragettes, but I think that we can leave that aside. What we're looking for in the West is clear compliance to the rules that have been made for everyone. But then what we really want to do is to get to the place where Warren and Charlie are, which is to have standards of behavior that are well above the bare minimum. And I'm kind of shocked. Well, I think that a mistake that many of us make is that because we spend so much time worshiping and idolizing the Berkshire Hathaway culture, is that we assume that everybody's like that, but everybody's not like that. So that has been a hard thing for me to learn and understand. And it still regularly comes up for me where I'm utterly shocked. Just to go into the investing world, how do we organize our societies is that we say, look, there's a bare minimum standard of behavior, which is the legal minimum. And it's just a fact of life that there are many people who will seek to use the bare legal minimum in order to succeed. And a place where I discovered it in a very painful way for me was in Delaware around the bankruptcy court, where there are vulture funds who have very, very high priced and extremely smart lawyers who work very carefully, completely and utterly within the system, to get some pretty nasty outcomes where they basically, it's not right to call it stealing because it's not stealing, but they'll convince a court that a company that's extraordinarily valuable is actually bankrupt because they've gotten the right combination of creditors to call default and they got the right circumstances. And it's a kind of a legal smash and grab. And you think, wow, is that actually possible? And yes, it is possible. You can do that. And then you have the same kind of behavior in many countries around tax rules. So where I've moved, for example, on tax rules is that I used to be far more aggressive on taxes, in which I really didn't want to pay any one bit more. I'd work quite hard to arrange myself taxation-wise. And I've come to the understanding that I choose to live in countries that have a social welfare state, and that entails higher taxes. And if I wanted to go and live in a Caribbean island, I could get away with paying zero taxes. But if I choose to live in countries like Switzerland or the UK or the United States, and you have to accept that. So, you know, I fully expect to be paying and will be proud to pay more and more taxes as I go through life, which is another kind of just coming into more complete compliance with the rules, or not trying to push the edges the way the kind of some of these bankruptcy attorneys do. I was bringing up to somebody recently this extraordinary thing. So if you look at Berkshire Hathaway and you ask yourself, where would somebody who's trying to optimize everything put, or who subjectively thinks they're optimizing everything, where would they locate the company? There's no question they'd locate Berkshire Hathaway insurance operations in a jurisdiction which doesn't require them to pay capital gains tax. And that would be places like Bermuda is one obvious example. And so I've seen a white paper written on how much money Berkshire Hathaway has left on the table because it's headquartered in Nebraska and isn't headquartered in Bermuda. And that's just not a choice that Warren Buffett would make. Completely legal. Absolutely. Plenty of very respected insurance companies at the time. Was a company called Excel and Ace Insurance and various others, Partner Re. I believe they were all based in Bermuda, and they were based there because it was a tax optimal jurisdiction for them. Berkshire Hathaway wasn't going to do it. What I don't know in that history, Bogmill, is that I think that Berkshire Hathaway has a very good relationship with the Nebraska Insurance Department. And I'm sure that the Nebraska Insurance Department appreciate the fact that Berkshire Hathaway could have gone to Bermuda. It didn't. It stayed and pays the taxes of the United States. I think that ultimately that is long-term greedy, because when you're a real partner to local governments, if you like, or to the governments where you're at. So what Google does and what Amazon do by not paying taxes, not paying sales taxes, is something that their tax lawyers clearly advise them to do. But they're not winning themselves friends in local jurisdictions where they do that. And I don't think it's probably not long-term optimal, if you like. Very lastly, and forgive me for the long answers to these very good questions, in terms of like completely, you can set up in an investment fund, you have a broad range of discretion within at least the law of what kind of fee structures, what kind of relationships you want to your clients. And there are plenty of people who charge 2 and 20, and they go to very sophisticated investors who can read all the documents, can make all their own decisions. And the investors voluntarily enter into a relationship with an investor where they pay them 2 and 20. And the law has nothing to say about that. So the movement, and that's all happened under the influence of Berkshire Hathaway and people around Berkshire Hathaway. And actually, Monish has said something to me on a flight between two Indian cities, probably, in which he said, you know, 99% of the sort of like the best possible behavior gets you about 50% of the way. Mm-hmm. In that it's when you actually take the care to do that last 1% that you actually get more than half the benefits. Because that's when people go, my God, it's the reaction that my father had to Warren Buffett that I was talking to you about earlier. Wow, that guy, he says it like it is. He's not trying to cheat anybody, period, end of story. And I've gone a long way, but I'm sure that I'll find other ways in which I could do more, if you like.
But I love it. Different perspectives and environments that people operate in. And I think it gives a better idea of understanding what ethics and right and wrong and following the rules can mean. I know we're at our time, but do you have 1 or 2 minutes
for
the last question I had?
Absolutely.
I'm curious about your definition of success. And I know it's a big question, but I love asking it. And I know you talk about your inner scorecard, but what's your definition of success? How do you know you're getting where you're going? Yeah. Or if there is a destination you have in mind?
It's definitely not a number. A financial mm-hmm. number. And I think I differ from a number of people I know in that regard. So first of all, I think that many people, so in New York City, investment bankers talk about their number. It's the number of dollars that you can kind of retire and afford to live the life that you want to live. I remember when I was young, my father used to say to me, you're rich if you can live off the interest of the interest. It was kind of a term that he used, which was an interesting idea. I remember being at age about 25 and saying to a good friend of mine who actually lives in Paris, that if I could be entrusted with $100 million at the time, I said to him like this, which I think is an interesting way of looking at it. If $100 million if I'm trusted by $100 million of wealth, those people are not going to argue with where I send my children to school, what vacations I take, and what kind of home I live in. So the basic circumstances of my life are going to be as good as you can have, effectively. And I think that's probably about approximately the kind of AUM that an investor needs. It doesn't even have to be theirs to achieve 99% of what they need, or 100% really of what they need materially. I got to that place. And that was an interesting perspective for me. And I started, and so now what happened to me is that, and it happens to people around my age, I think, so suddenly you realize the limited resources, time, not money. What do I want to fill my time with? I got to a place where I don't want to say change careers, if you like, because I think mm-hmm. that basically I enjoy what I do every day. I think that I love living in a world of ideas. I love thinking about things. I love reading and learning. And I'm in an environment where I can read and learn. The more I can do that, the better. I'm in a good place there. I think that what highly motivates me is an idea that, you know, that some famous, very rich guy died. This is a story told, of course, by Warren Buffett. It's all told by Warren Buffett. So many people came to his funeral. Only thing is that they came in order to see that he was really dead. That's how many enemies that person had. And before we go into the implications of those stories, the other one is that very, very rich guy died. Do you know how much wealth he left behind? And the person asked, well, how much? And the person said, all of it, you know? So, you know, you leave all of it behind. I think that to get to whatever the destination is with a group of friends who really value you, who are grateful that you're on the planet, who are grateful that you exist in their lives is something that is certainly a target for me. If I can, I don't want to die with no friends. I don't want to die with few friends. I want to die with many people who say it's great that he lived the life that he lived. He made a contribution. He was such a positive part of so many people's lives, I think is a good way to think about it. It used to be that at the end of the every year, I had a spreadsheet where I'd track my net worth. I'd track family net worth. I stopped doing that about 5 years ago, and I don't think that's the measure. And another very interesting measure of success, and by the way, how do you fill your time? And so in addition, reading and learning and having thinking through interesting ideas and problems, not necessarily just investment related, is something that clearly I love spending my time doing. I do enjoy sports an awful lot, and I like being outdoors an awful lot. And so I am happiest when I have a significant amount of time doing that. Just come to the end of a period where I've been away from my wife for 10 days and it's been miserable for me. So I really, really value the companionship of family and people who value me, not because I'm a business person or that because I'm an investor, but because I'm a person who loves them as family members, not as something else. So I think that those are key ingredients. I don't know them personally, but I've read plenty of stories about people who were super wealthy and had no friends and no family, and that sounds utterly miserable. And just briefly back to the ideas, I don't want to die not having read. I've got a list of works of literature that I would have liked to have read. So I'm currently reading Le Rouge et Le Noir, which maybe you know, French book. I'm reading it and I'm also listening to the audiobooks in French and English. The next one on my list is Thomas Mann's Buddha books. And I have goals in terms of my understanding of group theory, of Galois theory, of quantum mechanics. For no other reason that I would like to die having had a real grasp of what's underlying it. And some more basic things, I mean, graduate, even undergraduate mathematicians study Fourier transforms, mathematical magic, what happens when you do Fourier analysis. French mathematician, many, many great French mathematicians. So very profoundly and certainly not a net worth number and not even necessarily a rate of compounding. And obviously to target a rate of compounding can be extraordinarily dangerous. To end the answer to this question with one, something that I think is extraordinarily valuable for any listener who's like me, a huge fan of Warren Buffett. One of my huge conclusions from the launch is because you say, well, why does he spend all this time investing? How boring. And yeah, in a certain way, investing, if that's all you do, and it's pretty much all Warren Buffett does, you don't get to read James Joyce's Ulysses. You know, James Joyce's Ulysses is filled with so many unusual and fascinating things. There's so many worlds that one can explore. And the world of investing is just one world. And in a certain way, and especially when you get to the Berkshire Hathaway, it's a kind of a limited world. And there's how many investment ideas can you look at that you can put $5 or $10 billion into, which is what Warren Buffett has to restrict himself to. But my conclusion from the launch was that his particular personality and his particular set of interests are that is his happiest life. That is what fascinates him. And he's not particularly interested. He probably, you know, he's probably a good enough mathematician that he understands Fourier analysis. But if he didn't, doesn't interest him. And so you can send him a book about, you know, I don't know, study of the English novel in the 19th century, and he'll send it along to his friend Charlie and say, hey, tell me what's in it. And so it's really important to understand that Warren has built this enormous wealth. It's secondary to what he really, really loves to do. And somewhere, I think it was one of your questions, you know, be the best version of yourself, not Warren Buffett. I just have a broader set of interests, and I should be true to that, you know? Mm-hmm. I'd probably be a better investor if I'm true to that.
I think I know the answer, but let me ask anyway. Do you see yourself ever not working?
So work takes on a different definition. I'm not sure what. So I think that every single human to justify their place on their planet should either be working or learning. So, you know, certainly, just to be clear, that means working in my sense of the word. That means seeking to improve the world in some way. If you're bringing up children, you're improving the world. If you're cooking for your family, you're improving the world. If you are taking care of people, you know, so it's not about seeking out compensation, but work is, you know, it's actually a very Jewish, well, the Sabbath, the rabbis who fought long and hard about what does it mean to keep the Sabbath had to think long and hard about what was it to work. Mm-hmm. They came up with work as anything where you change the world. So they did allow, you could play chess, that's not work, play Scrabble, that's not work. Signing a document, that's work. You know, so we, it's a kind of, they reached a kind of a, worked out a definition of work, which is when you act on the world to change it, where you cannot change it back. They have these discussions in the Talmud about furniture. You know, if you move furniture around the house, it can be heavy physical labor. Mm-hmm. If you move it around for the sake of having the family over and then you move it back to where it was, mm-hmm. that's temporary, that's not work. But mm-hmm. if you're rearranging the furniture because you want to rearrange your house, that's considered work. So everybody should either be working or learning. Mm-hmm. I really believe that. Like that. And so I believe that I will fund my children's education for as long as they want to continue to educate themselves. And if they stop continuing to educate themselves, not a problem. Now it's time to go to work. And so I think that in that nature of work, I think that we all should be working and educating ourselves until the very... My mother is 85 years old. She goes to French classes. She's studying French, except mm-hmm. she had a cataract operation a couple of days ago. And I'm trying to convince her that she should be listening to Le Rouge et Le Noir with me. Uh-huh. And I haven't yet convinced her to do that. But I think that's... And sorry, just to... I'm very proud of them, actually. My father is... He went through a very unpleasant three-week stay in hospital. He had an ankle infection. Took a long time to get rid of. And he got out of hospital. He's walking now. And he is working hard to get his pilot's license back, to requalify as a pilot's license, because there's no better activity for him than flying in his twin engine Piper Aztec. And he wants to get the qualification back. And at age 85, he's doing that. And by the way, he still runs his business. He's the chairman of the business. He has a business manager, and it still makes money. So and I tell my father, hey, you're young. You know, Charlie's still going. He's working hard at 99. So don't, you know, don't think you can give up anytime soon. So no, I have no plans to. I think the nature of the work should change.
Of course.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know, but I fly small planes. I always wanted to be a pilot. So I know exactly how your father feels about flying and the call to be up in the air. And
what's your what type single
just,
twin?
Just a private pilot single engine, a
single
small
engine,
Cessnas
mm-hmm. high wing.
Yeah,
and do you have a instrument rating?
I don't. I started it.
Yeah.
I flew small Pipers, which are fun. They're the low wings.
Yes,
probably your dead flies with a twin engine.
Yes, instrument rating is a tough thing to get. And I grew up sitting next to my father as he flew all over the place, as I handled, whatever I learned an enormous amount about flying. When I got to the test that I needed to do before I flew solo, I flunked it. And I didn't really study for it because I felt like I knew everything. And when I flunked it, that was when I realized that I really had no interest in flying. So I stopped. I actually think that somebody like me, I'm distracted, ADHD. You don't want me flying planes. It's good. Good that I don't fly planes. Not my thing.
But it looks like you know a lot about flying.
From the position of, quote, co-pilot, sitting in the co-pilot seat and, adjusting. This was before GPS. So, looking for transponders, ADF, understanding how the transponder works, seeing where we were, helping my father call his position to various control towers as he flew around and close to controlled or uncontrolled airspace, hearing the radio, absolutely. And I think that the one really valuable, so two very valuable analogies for investors from flying. One is from Tom Russo, who's talked about how in investing, you don't want to overly focus on one instrument. You know, you have the speed indicator, you have where the engines are, you have the altitude, you have the pitch. If you start focusing on one to the expense of the others, you're going to stall the plane, you're going to do something. And so that's a kind of a nice analogy. Investing, you need to look at all the instruments. You need to look at all the variables. Don't overly focus on EPS or share count or cash generated or EBITDA or, you know, look at everything. It's a flying airplane, it's a complex thing as the business, and you want to look at all the variables. The second one that I like that has been hugely helpful for me is that I remember learning to land the plane and, you know, this idea of kind of like flaring the plane at the right moment so that you float down onto the runway. I don't know if it's every flying student. What you want to do is look over the side to see how close the ground is. And so this mm-hmm. skill of looking into the horizon, and it took me a while to learn. The instructor said, don't look down. I said, but how do I know if the ground's coming? He said, you've got to see it in your peripheral vision. I'm like, what peripheral vision? Where the hell is it? You know? And eventually I learned what that peripheral vision is. And it seems to me that this idea of keeping your eye on what the long-term goal is. And so the opportunities have to arise from the peripheral vision. But if you then turn your face to look at the thing that you're actually hoping for, you will stop flying the plane straight and level, and that will lead to disaster. So that seems to me to be a nice analogy.
Yeah, I think we looped back to risk and reward, looking at the two. Speed and altitude when you're flying, and risk and reward, both sides of the equation when you're investing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wonderful. And look, my checklist is 75 points and growing. So, you know, you could argue each one of those is kind of like an item on the, is a kind of another instrument, if you like. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pilots need their checklist, and so do investors. Guy, thank you so much for today. I really appreciate it. You're always very generous with your time. And I learned a lot. And
thank
I think
you.
Our audience will appreciate it as well. So thank you again.
And what I should say is that, you know, when you have great questions and you've asked some really, really good questions, I've learned a lot, because it's through interacting and through being asked great questions that you come up with learning and insight. So you've given me the opportunity to rethink a bunch of things, which I really appreciate. And a number of things come across about your personality, which I feel like I want to highlight for the listener. One is your extraordinary intelligence, and that comes through. I don't know how it comes through, but it does come through. The other is your very clearly, and this is something that we share, a fear of loss. It's not a fear, but a healthy respect for how easily it is to get mugged on the street corner, especially in the world of investing. And how things, and I think that this, I believe it's, and I may be projecting, it's a kind of a trait that you're more likely to learn in the Balkans or in Eastern Europe. Things aren't always the way they seem. Somebody describes it one way, but there's an underlying reality that may be quite different. And we need to look past the appearances to see what is actually going on. And even for the smartest people on the planet, that is not necessarily easy to uncover. And I have no doubt that you are an extraordinary protector of your clients' wealth. So they're lucky to have you.
Thank you. I always say that if they sleep well, I can sleep well. And I think that's a big goal for me as an investor, for other people especially.
And I would actually go one step further, is that if you don't sleep well, they can't sleep well. And so people have said, well, why don't you do this? Great opportunity. Yeah, there's risk, but it's a great opportunity. It's like, because I won't sleep well. Next question.
Quality of sleep is essential.
Yeah. So
thank you again. Lovely to see you.
Thank you.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seekard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seekard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents, available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.